Welcome to our flagship launch of A Journey into Excellence. My name is Vernon Boer. I'll be your host for this series coming up. I'm excited about doing it. I'm honored to be doing it. And we've got a great series planned for you. It's going to be a monthly series here. And let me just get right into this thing here. We're going to have a monthly panel of experts, and we're going to focus on how evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management skills. This is a flagship episode, and in this particular episode, I want to introduce our experts on the panel. We have four very talented, qualified experts that have formed this panel and outline the ground we're going to cover in the up-and-coming series. One of my favorite sayings is by the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, and I'm going to paraphrase this. He says, "We all have a right to know something about those who claim to be experts, whether we agree with them or not." And I think that's passionate, so in a good lead-in to the introductions. I'm going to start off with the introduction of Dr. Brian P. Higley, someone I've known for a long time. Our paths crossed in a very interesting fashion. And since Brian put in all the work to kind of get this off the road, we'll start with him, and then I'll go through the rest of the panel, and then we'll jump into it. So, Dr. Higley, do you mind if I call you Brian?
Oh, yeah, please do. Yeah.
I just want to make sure. Don't want to offend
anyone. Well, you normally call me, so why could we change things around, right?
That's why it sounds perfectly good to me, but I'm respectful. I'm of that generation, Doc.
Got it.
But, you know, Brian is the president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. He's a recognized leader in the area of positive and permanent change. Brian brings a whole unique mixture of things to the business research and psychological expertise. He's worked with a wide range of organizations from Fortune 500 level to small family business owned companies. He's also served as an executive coach to individuals across a wide variety of industries, including entrepreneurs, healthcare professionals, educators. He's also dedicated to high-quality teaching. He's taught a variety of courses across the board. He's been an instructor at the University of Florida, the University of Central Florida, the University of North Florida. Dr. Higley is also a research enthusiast. I'm sure as we go on, we'll find out something more about his research. He received his PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Florida. He's got tons of awards. This panel is incredible, folks, as you go through their bios. Anyway, that's Dr. Higley, a brief one. Anything you want to say or add to that I didn't, Brian, to flesh it out more?
Oh, no, I think you did a great job, and I think you were very complimentary to me, but I think it's by far the least impressive of the resumes of this panel, so I'm happy to have you move forward and describe everybody to our listeners.
Well, you know, you all have very impressive resumes, and that's both exciting and thrilling, and it's going to make for a good show. Second one I'm going to introduce here is Martin Heisacker. How do you pronounce your last name, Dr. Heisacker?
Heisacker, like H-A-Y-Sacker.
H-A-Y.
Yes,
thank you very much. I'm very so sorry about butchering that. So,
no worries.
Anyway, may I call you Martin?
Call me Marty.
Marty, okay. You're probably not old enough to remember a Disney series called Spin and Marty.
You know, I don't remember it, but I might still be old enough.
Anyway, Marty is a professor of psychology at the University of Florida. He earned his PhD in 1983 from the University of Missouri. He has served on as chair of so many institutions and boards. He's been the University of Florida's chair of the Department of Psychology, an association of heads of the departments of psychology, council of counseling psychology training programs. He currently serves on the executive board of PsyCAS. Is that how you pronounce it? It's the Universal
Yes.
Application Initiative for Graduate Training. Dr. Haysacker has co-authored over 120 scholarly publications, over 150 conference presentations, four of which were invited. He's supervised or co-supervised over 30 doctoral dissertations. For those of you people that don't understand, that's a lot of work to guide those people through a PhD dissertation. Was Brian one of your PhD students?
Brian was not one of my students, although I did serve as a member of both his master's thesis committee and his doctoral dissertation committee. So that's actually how I became familiar with Brian's work.
Well, that's one of the questions I had for later, because I think that's fantastic. Like I say, his publications go on and on. I could read his whole bio. If I read all your bios, I could probably chew up probably the first half of the show. But as we get into it, to the extent that you want to go further than that, you can tell the people. Anything else you want me to add to that, Marty?
Nope, I think that was more than enough. Thank you.
Yep. Jack Malcolm is the president of the Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism, preparation, and productivity of sales professionals in complex sales environments through training and consulting sales planning. That's a mouthful. Jack's personal areas of expertise include sales, finance, psychology of personal communication, and persuasion. What I found in 1996, he founded the Falcon Performance Group to combine his complex sales expertise and financial background to design and implement sales improvement initiatives at top national and international corporations. All these guys have been engaged with top-level business people. And one of the things I find exciting about this is you all are engaged out there in the business world or academic world, and one of the things that's fascinated me about the possibility of the technology is bringing people that have your expertise and background and training into the public eye to give back at a community level, as I should say, because many of the times I found, because I was in academia for a while, that never the twain shall meet, and I think that's fascinating. And all of your – I will post links when I post this as a podcast to all your sites. People need to go to Jack's site for his Falcon Performance Group, because he gives a very interesting discussion of how he got to where he was. And I think that that's fascinating for many of us to see how we wound up where we are. Anything else I should say, Jack?
Yeah, Vern, I really appreciate that. The only thing that I want to add is that – besides Falcon Performance Group, I'm now doing a lot of work, and I have another website called jackmalcolm.com. And the reason I bring that up is that a lot of my work has expanded beyond simply sales professionals. So the entire rubric of persuasive communication is really where I just love to write about. I love to teach it. I love to learn as much as I can, and I'm excited to be in a company of three people that I know that I can learn a lot from. So I'm really looking forward to this. Thanks.
Well, same here. And John, last but not least, you know, I always struggle with these things, the order in which to introduce people, because I know for the most part you're all educated, you're professionals and everything. But sometimes egos get involved, not in your case, but I struggle with it. So
just make some stuff up. It's okay, Vernon. And Jack, you said in the company of three people, there's four on the phone, so I'm guessing I'm the fourth that didn't count there. Hey, John, you know me pretty well. I've hung around you long enough that I've gotten bad at numbers.
I'm like, in the company of three billion people I can learn from.
No,
I must not be.
I used to be good with numbers until I talked to John. And as we go along, you'll find out what I mean.
So three people he can learn from, and then John, too.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I'm just along for the ride. Okay, Vernon, sorry.
That's perfectly okay. That's what, you know, listen, part of what makes things powerful in life is when you can have fun with it. Too many people are too serious these days, in my opinion. And the comment about numbers is fascinating because my basic training was in physical chemistry. I worked with a lot of numbers over my life, and I find them fascinating. But I have this sense that the general population at large is still kind of stuck in grade school with the fear of arithmetic and mathematics and doesn't have the expertise that we really all should have in just dealing with basic numbers and figures and sorting through stuff like that. So with that, John, I'm going to introduce you further. John is recognized as one of the top business thought leaders and leadership development experts in the world, and was named by the American Management Association as one of America's top 50 leaders to watch. Now, that's pretty impressive. As a consultant and coach to organizations worldwide, from startups to Fortune 10, I'm used to Fortune 500, John is dedicated to helping people with business. Sorry about that. Businesses
that's quite
all
right.
be more successful. by making
I got a few
business
that are 492.
Well, Jack and her talked about the three. We got 490 more to go for the 500. But John, you are an expert at making the very complex awesomely simple, and we're gonna talk about that in a bit. For more than 23 years, John has traveled worldwide helping people. You're an author of 5 books and co-author of several more. You're a business consultant. You've consulted Fortune 500 firms. We got that in there. At 26, you were the CEO of an international Rockefeller Foundation, is what it says in your bio, overseeing projects in 20 countries. I mean, I should just go back to bed and forget about it. John was named one of the 8 finalists for the Breakthrough Idea Award for the Thinkers 50 in 2017. He's a voracious learner. John, anything I missed that you want everyone to know at this particular point in time? Because we'll learn more about all of you as the show goes on.
No, I could make up some jokes, but I won't do that.
Well, if they're good, save them for later, and we'll get into it. So for you, the listening audience, you can see we have a huge expert panelist that brings something unique to this discussion and the journey we're about to embark on. And so I want to get right into it. And the first question that came up, and it was kind of hit upon briefly in the introductions, and I'm going to start with Brian here because he helped me put this together, and that is, how did you all meet and come to work together? And Brian, you can kick it off. And then what I think would work well at this point in the discussion is when you said what you have to say, throw it on to the next panelist. You pick whoever you want, John, Jack, Marty, and back and forth until we've gone through everyone, and we'll continue on from there.
That sounds great. So, Vern, when you suggested the name Journey into Excellence for this podcast, I thought it was just a perfect way to describe what I've essentially been doing over the last couple of decades, and really what I've been journeying into is excellence into 3 different systems that I think might be the most influential systems maybe in the world. The first system is the family system, which is the initial system that most of us enter into. The second system is the education system, which typically is the second system that people enter into. And then the third system is the leadership/management system, which is typically the third system that people enter into. And I've been journeying into these 3 different systems in 3 different roles. The first role was as a student, where I would learn from my family and learn from my educators and learn from my leaders. The second was sort of as a teacher/learner, where I would become the person that was helping people to come to certain kinds of realizations and conclusions. And then the third was what I call sort of a consultant to the teacher or teacher of teachers, where people would have me come in and talk with teachers or talk with parents or talk with leaders and managers about certain kinds of best practices. And as I've been journeying into these 3 different systems, the whole time I've been assessing the degree to which what is happening in those systems seems to me to align with what I've come to call the science of learning, change, and growth, also known as the Science of Life, Liberty, and Happiness Pursuit. And the way that I've met all of the panelists are they are some of the people who I have found to be the hardest workers with regard to trying to align what it is that they do within these systems, the family, the education, and or the leadership management system, with the actual science of learning, change, and growth, or life, liberty, happiness pursuit. And so when you mentioned the idea of maybe having a series like this, they are the first people that I thought about bringing on in terms of the panelists, along with a few other people that we might be able to get on to the series as well on down the line. And really my vision for this is to invite more and more people into what I've been privileged to have, and that is these ongoing discussions with people like Jack and John and Marty about excellence across those three different systems and what we can do to make those systems even more excellent so that we can raise the level of our families, of our businesses, of our education system, and of our culture as a whole. So maybe I'll just leave it right there and just say that I'm really thankful for everybody, and I'm really excited about what we can do with this podcast series. And I can throw it over to any person, so maybe I'll toss it over to whoever's talking now.
Yeah, well, that's actually me, because I want you to make a note here before as you pass this on. I want you to make a specific note about family, and I'll tell you why. Is one of the things I've become intrigued with over the years is the family is probably the smallest group that has any tight ties and relationships in this world. It all kind of begins with families, and I've come to think that given the state of how families get along, it's not that hard to see why the world looks the way it does. So I just want you to, you know, in the future we'll talk about that more, because I think that's very important. So with that, why don't you pass it on to the next panelist?
Okay, well, since you touched on family, I think probably the most qualified, maybe of all of us, I might be overlooking something, to talk about best practices when it comes to families is Marty Haystacker. So if everyone's okay with that, maybe I'll just kind of toss it to Marty, and if he wants to pick up on the family issue, fine, and if he wants to jump somewhere else, I'm open to that too.
So thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. What I was actually thinking was if I were a person now tuning into this podcast, the thing I would want to know right now is what's the point of all this? And so, to me, one of the points of it is the one that Vern just mentioned, which is that we can help listeners take the steps needed for them to be part of a family that they're proud of and to be a family member that they are individually proud to be. The second thing is that I think that this set of podcasts will help people become or remain the person that they're proud to be. So I often with people say, let's think about what your obituary is going to look like at the end of your life. With young people, it's not that they think they're going to live forever, so it doesn't work as well. But for people over about 40 or 50, it's a salient thing. And I say part of what we're trying to do with this journey into excellence is make sure that you have been the person you wanted to be, that you've done the things you wanted to do. That is, the obituary written about you is the obituary you would want to have written about you. And then the third thing I think makes this set of podcasts useful to listeners is we can help people provide people with the tools and the perspectives to be part of organizations that they're proud of, whether it is where they work, whether it is their government, whether it's their church, any other organization of which people are a part. What the four of us have really done is engaged in a series of activities and efforts to try to optimize how well our organizations work, how well our families work, and how well our lives work to achieve the things that we value, whatever those things are. So with regard to the family, what I would say very quickly is the principles that we're going to set out and outline throughout this series of podcasts work beautifully in the family. They work in my family. I am a devotee of this journey into excellence. I practice it imperfectly, but I practice it every day, and that has had tangible benefits in my own family. I'm a better family member. My family is more peaceful. We're more focused about what we do and how we do it. We know what are the things that don't matter that much, and we don't spend too much time and energy on those. And we know what things matter a lot. We spend more time and energy on those. And so I think that's what I want to say. John, do you have a thought you want to add to that?
Well, no, I think, Vernon, you sort of asked how we all got together, and I'll give you a little bit of the background of how we became friends and colleagues working together. After I left the Rockefeller Foundation, I went to work for a company that did very high-level sales training. And when I arrived, they said, there's a gentleman that works here that you're not going to get along with because he's really, really, really good at what he does, and he's highly competitive. And he's turned out to become one of my best friends in the world. That's Jack. And he was really my mentor when I entered into the training and speaking business. I'm pretty proud of the fact that I read, 100 books or so a year. Jack basically crushes me. Brian, I can't exactly remember. I think that we met through a professor at the University of Florida, but please refresh my memory.
Oh, this, I'll never forget this. After my master's thesis was completed, I was asked by Jan Makovich at the Gaines Health and Fitness Center to come on over and talk with their people about what I found, because my master's thesis was on factors that differentiate between wishing to do things and actually doing those things. So he asked me to come over and talk with the members of the Gainesville Ultra Fitness Center, which was one of the top fitness centers in America. I think it still is. John, you'd be able to comment on that. But
it's top 10 in the world.
Yeah, not just the nation. I undersold them. Yeah, it's just amazing what they're doing over there. So I was talking with the members about how they could use these five factors, and we can talk maybe a little bit more about the five factors later if you all want to do more of the exercise that they wish to do. And it just so happened that in the audience was this big shot business guy named John Spence, who came up to me after the presentation, and he gave me a life-changing challenge. He basically said, Brian, this sounds great. If you can create some kind of organizational training series that will help organizations do more of what they wish collectively, I think this would be great. And so I looked at John and said, would you help me to do it? He said, yeah. And that started the whole process off of about 10 or 15 years of us traveling around together, doing all kinds of workshops where he would talk about what to do, and then I would talk about how to actually implement it over the long haul.
Cool. Well, it's 15 years ago, so I'll claim oldness of not being able to remember that. And then met Marty through Brian. So as Brian just said, the four of us have been working together, colleagues, helping each other out in different ways, shape, or form for basically 20 years. And it's interesting that all of us have a similar view on from different points of view, but a similar view on the topics we're going to talk about around excellence. So that is my input, Vernon.
Jack, that leaves you.
All right. Well, John has already said how we met, but I probably need to put a little perspective from my side of it. I had this young dynamo, what I call a Tasmanian devil of a guy, came in and joined the company. And our boss said, hey, you're taking this guy with you on your next training class. And I said, come on, Al, do I have to? He said, yeah, you have to. So I took him, and we became friends after about 2 days, because he was the kind of guy that was willing to do anything to make sure that whatever we were trying to do to make the mission happen, whether it was running down the hall to get somebody at the hotel to, I don't know, supply us with something that we didn't have, or whatever, John was the guy that was out there doing all that. And I still remember, I believe it was in St. Louis at the time. We left after 3 days of training there. The hotel staff came out and clapped when John was leaving. And I mean, he was leaving, but because they liked John so much. I think they chipped in and bought him a shirt or something like that. So
I remember that. They didn't clap for you, but man, I got the standing ovation. Man, Jack, that's a memory. Wow.
And And then the funny part was is I noticed what he had in his backpack. He had about six books on sales, and when you open one of the books, he would highlight the parts that he thought were important. And the funny thing was is that the every book probably had about 90% highlights and 10%. And I said, John, how the heck are you gonna remember this? And he said, well, that's simple. I pay somebody to transcribe this stuff, and then I read over the notes. And I said, wow, that's pretty impressive. So that's how I got to know John. And speaking about our boss, he quickly became a common enemy. So we were united in that as well. So we became friends. We both went out on our own, left the company, and collaborated, learned from each other all throughout the years. I know he introduced me to Brian sometime around probably that time that you got to know him, Brian, and we've been in touch throughout the years. And Marty, we are just meeting for the first time, and I'm looking forward to getting to know you better.
Same here.
You know, I'm struck by the fact, listening to Martin there, as he said, that people want to know what the show is about. And that's actually, we'll get into this as the next part of the question, and he can start that round off. One of the things that you said was about working toward excellence. What struck me is that unless you and I have achieved perfection, there's always something more that we can do to forward our excellence in this experience and our participation in life, or so it seems to me. And couple that with something I remember for a long time ago, being in college, one of my instructors used to always like to say, the answers to life are not in the back of the book. Coupled with the final thing, journey, could you speak a little bit about, or two, the concept of embarking upon a journey into excellence and where you can see this taking us in our participation in terms of how it can assist and help others that listen to this podcast in the future?
Absolutely. So I'll give a little bit, but I certainly want to hear from the others as well, because I think we all have different aspects of this that are really important. So the first thing I keep in mind is, and I'm sure this is my background, I'm a sailor. I love sailing. And so the way I think about this journey is just like sailing a boat. And I say the boat is never in tune. You've always got to tweak some sail. You've always got to either pinch up to the wind or fall off to the wind. It's a continuous process of adjustment. And the journey into excellence has already begun. It began at the moment of our birth, and it will continue on to the end of our lives and beyond that when we leave a legacy. So during that process, we're sailing. We're adjusting all the time. And sometimes the boat is way, way, way out of whack, and the sails are flapping around, and the boat is a mess. And sometimes it's for a few brief seconds, it's perfectly in tune, and then we retune. But I think the journey into excellence is a journey of being committed to keep adjusting the sails and keep moving in the direction that you want to move in. So for me, and we're going to get into some very specific tools that are very helpful in that regard. But what this starts with, in my mind, is being clear about what your mission, the mission is for your life, for your family, for your organization, what the objectives are that bounce off of that vision or that mission you have for yourself, your family, your organization, what particular goals you have to achieve those objectives, what tasks you're going to engage in to meet those goals, that meet those objectives, that create or complete that vision. It's a process that starts with being really clear about who do you want to be, what do you want to do. That's to me the initial step in this sailing process, sort of like figuring out, where am I sailing to?
Am I on course?
Exactly.
Brian, you want to say something about that?
Yeah, so speaking of on course, a couple of things that made me think about all these panelists, Vernon, when we started talking about a journey into excellence. I've been really fascinated as we've continued this journey and with these folks here. I think I'm up to about 20 or 25 years interacting with all these fellows. And one of the things that continuously sort of interests me, amazes me, is how much of what we do actually overlaps. And so I thought we might answer a question that I think is really important and related to Am I on Course, and that is, what is excellence? So for me, I've come to sort of think about, well, what excellence is the ability to do things that are obviously and in an evidence-based way helpful to both ourselves and others. And I use an acronym H2O to kind of summarize that excellence is H2O, helpful to ourselves and others, two H's or two O's instead of the normal two H's. And when I think about a lot of Jack's work, I think a lot of that circles around civility and clear thinking. And I think that H2O is also civility and clear thinking. So I think much of what my work is the same thing as what Jack's doing. We might use different words and we might have different audiences. And on top of that, John has, I think you mentioned, Vern, his one of his slogans is making the, I think it's incredibly complex, awesomely simple. He's got a great book out right now called Awesomely Simple. And much of what I read in Awesomely Simple relates to civility and clear thinking and H2O. So one of the themes for me of this entire Journey into Excellence series is H2O is civility and clear thinking, and civility and clear thinking is awesomely simple, to kind of get across how much what we do overlaps. But to me, excellence is doing the things that regularly, obviously, and in an evidence-based way is helpful to the self and helpful to other people simultaneously. If you leave any of those out, if you're helping other people in a way that doesn't help you, or if you're just helping yourself in a way that doesn't help other people, I think that you're not quite at the level you could be when it comes to excellence. And like what Marty said, we'll be able to sort of flesh out a little bit more of what that means from Jack's perspective, from John's perspective, from my perspective, and from Marty's perspective. But that's really what I'm thinking about when I think about excellence.
You know, Brian, when you say being someone with that was in the physical sciences, what came to mind when you were saying what you just did is that on the course to excellence is kind of like putting the energy in to stave off the natural effects of entropy that life throws our way.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Jack.
Wow. I actually have a lot of things that I think I can play off of on what you said. So I'm going to try to keep it brief here, but I want to go back for a second about to what Marty said about the obituary, because it reminded me, I think it's David Brooks calls it, there's two sets of virtues that people can be compared by. There's the resume virtues, and then there's the eulogy virtues. And I think that's very important, that when you're pursuing excellence, yeah, you certainly want to pursue excellence in the resume virtues. You want to be as well educated as possible. You want to achieve as much as possible. You want to lead as many people to whatever success that they want. At the same time, you want to do it in such a way that you're developing your personal character, your potential for growth. And to me, that whole idea of excellence is not a destination, it's a journey. And just embarking on that journey to say, I'm not satisfied, my boat's not completely in tune, I can do better. The wind shifted. Now I suddenly have to do something else. That idea of entropy is something I've thought of a lot about lately as well, because I find that when it comes time to keeping a successful business going, you need to put energy in, and energy is the only thing that's going to keep entropy at bay. If you don't put the energy in and you don't put it in the right focus, then it's all going to start falling apart. So there's a lot of things that you've said here that I'd love to continue following up on as we talk.
You know, Jack, when you're talking about the journey, one of the things that comes to mind, too, and it struck me many years ago, it's much like the concept of 100%. I came to realize or suspect many years ago that 100% can only be experienced in the moment. Because the instant after you put it all in, your mind takes over and tells you what more you could have done. So it's something that's ongoing. You're always interacting with it. And like I say, I happen to have a fondness for many of the physical sciences because I think there's a lot, not that they're particularly special or better than others. I can come up with a lot of metaphors from them, like entropy.
Yeah. But and just one thing that I would say, and I want to be sure that we're clear about who our audience is for this, because as you said, every time you give 100%, then you right afterwards you say, gee, what could have I have done better? I wonder if everybody thinks that way. I believe that all of us on this panel right now think that way, but I don't know if everybody does. And I would think that there are some people that tend to maybe be satisfied with less than their best.
Jack, I'm going to jump in on that because I think you just stole a little bit of my thunder. As we were talking about this, there's a quote. It's listed to be Tom Peters, the author. It's probably Lao Tzu or something like that, or Buddha. But it says, how long does it take to become excellent? 1 second and the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's the 1 second to make the decision that I want to pursue excellence, that I truly want to be excellent, and now I'm willing to put in the work for the rest of my life to never achieve that, to never quite make it. But, you know, Jack, you and I travel all over the world doing this sort of stuff. I unfortunately say the majority of people never make that decision.
Yeah.
They say, I just, you know, above average would be nice. I'm not with, because, and it's not that they don't believe that excellence would be great. It's just the amount of energy, effort, time, dedication, discipline it takes to truly make a decision in your life that you want to pursue excellence, go on that journey. I think a lot of people get to the edge of that and go, I'd just rather go have a beer.
Yep.
Heineken, by the way.
So this is Marty. I have a slightly different take on that, and a slightly different take is this. What I notice when I work with people is it's really a challenge for us to do the hard work of figuring out what is it that we truly value. What is our vision for our lives? What are the things we value above all other things? What are the roles that we want to enact that are more important than other roles? I noticed that we all have a challenge, not all of us, but it is a very common challenge for people to do that work to really own who they are and what they value. But that once people own that piece, understand this is what is important to me, and by implication, this is what's less important. This is a central role in my life. This is a secondary or a tertiary role in my life. Once people have done that work and then they align their efforts to be aligned with those most important goals, roles, missions, then the motivation to be excellent sort of takes care of itself. So I think where that glitch is, if people say, oh, the heck with it, I'll just have a Heineken, I think where that starts is that it's a really hard thing for us to do that most important work of defining who we are and what is most important to us and what are the most important roles we're going to fulfill in this world and in our lives. To me, that's the place where that resistance happens.
And I'll jump in and say that John, do you want to go ahead? I'm sorry.
No. You go first, and then I'll try to see if I can come up with something smart by the time you're done.
Okay. So those kinds of decisions are really interesting to me, and I plan on at some point in this podcast series to talk a little bit about how the family system, the education system, and the business leadership system can contribute to or increase the probability that people will make those kinds of decisions that John was speaking about, or for a variety of different reasons, decrease the probability that people will make those kinds of decisions. So I'm really excited to talk about, from a systems level, how family systems, education systems, and leadership management systems can make it more probable that people will want to pursue excellence, or decrease the probability that people will want to make that choice.
Cool. Well, here's – this will go along with that. And, Marty, this is in response to some of the stuff you said. I think the three of you guys know, and Vernon, I've been teaching a class off and on – not off and on – for about 30 years on achieving personal excellence. It's a class that, that used to be called Strategies for Success. Now we call it College and Life Success. I've taught it at about 90-plus colleges and universities around the world to more than 250,000 college students. And I also teach it in my classes at Fortune 10, Fortune 500 companies, other companies like that. And one of the first exercises I have is I have people write down their personal core values. I'm going to be quoting people all day today, but I have a great Walt Disney quote I love: when values are clear, decisions are easy. So I go, let's start with your values. And 95%, 98% of the people in the room have never written them down. They will stare at that page. I've had them cry. I give them 20 minutes and they can't write anything on the page. And then maybe out of a group of 100, I'll have one or two people that either write it quickly or I'll have one person that'll reach in their pocket and pull their card out and go, here's my personal core values that I live every day. And it's fascinating to me, Marty, when you say about understanding why we were going on this journey, that in my experience with literally hundreds of thousands of people, the vast majority of people, if you put a gun to their head, could not tell you their strongest, clear, personal core values.
Right.
John, can I interrupt here a second? I want to ask you a quick question. You've been doing this a long time. Have you found that the inability of people to express their core values has gotten worse over time, about the same?
That's a great question. It's about the same, maybe a little bit worse, because we live in trying times with a lot of challenges and stress and things going on. And I think also when you look at electronics and phones and iPads and things, that people, in my opinion at least, it seems to me that people are not quite as reflective and they're not spending the time looking inward when it's so easy to be distracted by Facebook or something on your iPad. But the number's always been incredibly low, Vernon. It's only been a couple of people out of 100 will ever have any idea what their values were before they showed up in the class.
That's almost biblical. Many are called, few are chosen.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm going to go back to something. This is Marty. I'm going to go back to something that Brian said earlier. I think that, and he will amplify on this in a way better than I can, but I think that the secret sauce of changing that has to do with helping to educate families and school systems and educators and people that lead organizations to keep that issue on the front burner for everybody all the time.
Yeah,
when I
teach those classes, I expect the students, the young students, the high school seniors and the college people that I teach to struggle with this a little bit. Because it's, you know, they're still forming those values. They've been living their family's values that were sort of, put on top of them up until that point. And then finally they hit a sense of freedom of, hey, I get to make a few of the choices for my life. Maybe I believe some of the stuff I was taught at home. Maybe I don't, things like that. I would expect them to struggle. But when I have a room full of 50-year-old people who are senior managers in companies, and they can tell you the strategy of their business, and they can tell you that. They know their market. They know the competition. They know this, that, and the other. But they have no idea what they truly value in their life. And I think, you know, why we're here is to help the people that are listening understand some of that, take it up, learn it, use it, and then apply it to go further down that journey of excellence.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on that one because it's so important. I need to throw something out there. I'm sorry to interrupt like this, you know, is that – inherent in what you say is there's something powerful about saying that you want to get people to see what's important to them when they're younger, prior to just on their deathbed. Realize what's important. What? Go ahead.
I can speak on that, or I can wait and have, I think it was John who had other things to say about that.
No, it's just in when I see this, and you guys have seen it too, it breaks my heart when I see somebody who's 45 or 50 or 55 look up from the piece of paper with tears running down their eyes. I'll give you a very quick example. I was teaching a class in Atlanta, senior executives. I challenged some folks there to do this. They were really struggling, and one woman in particular was struggling, and she looked up, and she was crying, and I asked why. She goes, I've never done this before, and I just put family and God as my top two core values. I only see my kids 15 or 20 minutes a night. The older ones I haven't talked to in a year, and I haven't been to church in 3 years. I am living a life in total violation of my own personal values. And I felt bad that I forced her to write them to see it. But by the same token, I would rather see people in their early 20s begin to form those and work on them and think about them and hold them close and examine their lives in relation to their values than have someone at 50 realize I have been out of alignment with my values for 20 years. And I'm going to be quiet and let you guys talk for a while.
I think that's a perfect segue into some of my analyses of these different systems that I'll just keep bringing up, the family system, the education system, and the leadership management system. One of the things that we know about human behavior, including what you pay attention to or what you ignore, is that if a system is reinforcing a certain behavior, it's much more likely that large groups of people will do it. If a system is either ignoring or punishing some behaviors, then it's less likely that you're going to do it. So one of the things that Marty and I have been doing, and I think Jack and John are doing it in their own ways as well, is trying to introduce into family systems, education systems, and into leadership systems the idea of being very clear about what we call roles and objectives. Now, there's all kinds of different ways to talk about this. You can call them values, whatever it is that you want to say. But essentially, the first thing that we tend to do when we're working with families, when we're working with students, and when we're working with leaders is sit them down and do the very thing that John has noticed people have never done. We have them identify the most important roles in their lives, and then we have them identify two or three of the most important objectives that will help them to live those roles out. And then after that, everything we do follows from those roles and objectives. Now, what I've noticed in most of the systems, family systems, education systems, leadership management systems, is that people do not start with people's values. They typically start with something that has nothing to do with their values. So I think a great example in the education system is most students are used to having educators come in and give them syllabi or give them directions and say, this is what we're going to do. They are shocked to find that when I work with them, the first thing I do is not say, here's what you're going to do. The first thing I ask them to do is the very kind of exercise that John suggests. And after that, I ask them to learn in ways that align with their values, their objectives, and their roles. And what's always interesting to me is, and this is one of the things that I'm really interested in, is the degree to which these systems align with the literature on learning, change, and growth. And what we know from
the scientific literature.
Scientific literature on that. Thanks, Marty. Yeah. And what we have found is that if you want to create really intrinsically motivated people, the kind of people that Jack and John were talking about who really are chomping at the bit to do what it is that they want to do in an excellent way, you need to start with the goals, the values, and the preferences of the individual and work from there. And what I found in most of these systems, whether they're family, education, leadership management systems, is they do the very opposite thing that the research tells us to do, which is you ignore the goals, the values, and the interests of the individual and just sort of impose on those people activities and goals that they have no participation in forming. And so it's just really interesting to me to see how that plays out in the culture and, according to John, the world, that these little sort of decisions that we make as family members, as educators, and or as leaders can play out in huge ways, including people like what John just talked about, 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, writing down for the first time what their values, their roles, and objectives are, and looking back in what Eric Erickson, who's a famous psychologist, would say, despair, rather than looking back with integrity. And so the work that I think we're all doing in our own ways is to try to impact these three systems in a way that helps set people up for a life of integrity rather than a life of despair.
Brian, if I could jump in for a second, just one point, and I'm glad you said that, because I've had for the last hour have been waiting to throw this in. You talk about the three systems, the family, the education system, and the leadership management system. And my whole question was, don't we need to start with the individual system? And I truly believe that within ourselves, we can almost look at the way we think almost as an operating system. And we can analyze that. We can break it down and figure out where are ways that we can improve this and upgrade our operating system, if you will, just to use that as kind of a metaphor for what we're talking about. So aren't there really four systems we should be talking about and concentrate on the individual system first?
That's interesting, and I've seen literature in both directions, and the way that I think about all of these systems rather than as an either-or, so we need to do this before mm-hmm. that, is I think about both and.
Okay.
And so for me, So for me, when I look at the individual systems, I think there are individuals, and I think that this panel are, to me at least, are representative of these individuals who are breaking out of the system and sort of doing this stuff on their own, which I think is great. So the thing that I'm interested in is, why are there so few individuals doing this? And so looking at it from a systems perspective, if you have few individuals behaving in a certain way, the probability is that the system either ignores those behaviors or punishes those behaviors.
Yeah.
So I'm completely on board with you in terms of individuals doing this, and that's something that I promote on a regular basis like you do, I think. But what I'm really interested in is, why aren't the systems churning out hundreds of thousands or millions of these kinds of people? And I think that one of the answers, it doesn't have to be the only answer, is working from a systemic, multi-person sort of worldview. But it doesn't mean that I don't believe in thinking about the individual.
And I agree, and I'm reminded of a quote by Deming. He said, put a good man into a bad system, and the system will win every time.
Oh, perfect.
Beautiful.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So, Jack, that's what's happening. Yeah.
Yep.
So, Jack, I actually do exactly what you say. I do often think about the individual as an organizing system with the same kind of features and traits as the family, the educational system, So that resonates for me as well. And I honor what both Deming and Brian are saying here. The truth is, there is the situation you're in has a very powerful influence on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Brian quickly jumped over something that I think is super important. What he mentioned was this developmental psychologist, Eric Erickson, who plotted out adult development. So the point he made there was that one of the things that we're all devoted to doing is facilitating our own lives and the lives and work of other people, so that at the end of their lives, at their last developmental stage, they have what Erickson called integrity instead of the alternative, which Erickson called despair. And the point is that when you have expended your time, your treasure, and your resources in ways that align with who you wanted to be and what you wanted to do, the final developmental stage before you pass off this mortal coil will be characterized by a sense of integrity. And if not, it will be characterized by a sense of despair, a life not well lived. And I think part of what drives me personally in this process is I have witnessed a grandparent who died with integrity and another grandparent who died in despair. And it was so burned into my consciousness. I was a young man in my 20s, and they died within a couple of years of each other, but it was so striking and so important to me. And I realized, because these are my family, this is my future. I will have one of these two futures. And I think that's why when I started to learn Brian's work and get involved in Brian's work, it so powerfully hit me, because I had already been pre-tenderized by this vision of these two grandparents with two very different last developmental steps.
Wow, yeah.
That's an interesting comment, because I remember I knew an anesthesiologist that was quite successful throughout his life as an anesthesiologist, an accomplished pilot, flew up to Alaska yearly to to fish and do all sorts of other things. And he was, when he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I remember seeing him toward the end of his life there. And I was puzzled in a way because he seemed to have this great disappointment that he'd never been able to go on a cruise, and like somehow that was life's failure. And I thought, for someone as accomplished, and by the way, he was a good Catholic too, nothing to bash Catholics about, but I thought, you know, what is there about your life or life that you can't see all your accomplishments to overwhelm this one thing that you think is a failure, the one thing you look forward to? Struck me as strange. So, clear thinking. What seems to be coming out of this, a couple of things come out of this for me at this particular point, is part of what we're hitting on the edges on, and which we'll actually flesh out and get into more detail later, revolves around clear thinking. But I also notice here that we've talked about to achieve excellence or engage in the journey of excellence, one has to have goals and objectives. And to engage in that journey, much like someone trained in any profession, you also need to learn tools and methodology. And if you don't, if you conflate or confuse the two, you're in trouble. And so does anyone want to run any place with that one? Because that really strikes me is when you start talking about the educational system, what I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, we don't know what we're going to use this for, and I didn't learn to use most of this. I never used most of the stuff I learned in school. And I've come to see a lot of the lower grade education is providing kids growing up, and I'm not saying there aren't things that could be changed about that, with a set of tools, like a brand new complete tool set from Sears, that they may or may not use all those tools, but they don't know what they're going to need or what they're going to use, and it should expose them to the fact that those are tools, some of which they may need, some of which they might not use, but you're better off to have a full tool set as you go through life than either not have the right tool for the job, etc. Anyone want to run with that for a second?
So, Vernon, I think your metaphor is fantastic. I think what the four of us will probably agree on, I'm going out on a limb here, is that there are some absolutely essential tools that ought to be in every child's toolbox and which are not reliably, consistently in every child's toolbox, and that they don't learn how to use those tools, and then as life rolls on, they become more and more challenged, and then they become that woman that John was talking about who realizes for years and years, I have lived completely out of sync with the two most important roles of my life, which were as a mother and as a person of faith. So to make that particular example, I think that the set of tools around who am I, what do I value, what are my life's missions and goals, those are the tools that I think we are not consistently teaching our kindergartners, our elementary schoolers, our middle schoolers, our high schoolers, our collegians. And one of the things I love about what Brian does in the classroom is he basically reintroduces that set of tools, or maybe for the first time is introducing that set of tools to the college students that he's teaching.
You know, Marty,
well,
go
ahead, Vern.
No, go ahead.
Well, I might jump in here because I see a lot of potential here in terms of some of the work of both Jack and John. I have a bunch of things that I could say, but one of the things that I thought about as Marty was talking about tools was John's concept of best people in his book, Awesomely Simple. I think the best people have the right tools. And then our lean communication expert, Jack, who I think really boils a lot of these tools down into both civility and clear thinking. So I don't know if either of you want to talk a little bit about tools with regard to the best people having the tools that they need, or in Jack's case, having tools that allow you to be civil and allow you to think clearly. But those are the things that came to my mind in Jack and John's work as Marty was talking.
Well, I'll respond to the best people first. And there's a couple of ideas to think about that. In the book that I wrote, when I'm referring to best people, I'm talking about best employees. Because in every role, it's a different best. And best is not perfect. Again, it's striving. But I think when you look at the best employees, they're the ones that are curious and always trying to improve, sort of a term I call personal Kaizen. I want someone on my team that, has skills and abilities, has a great attitude, has high integrity, tells the truth, plays well with other people in the sandbox. But best to me at, that level is someone who has a strong desire for consistent and constant improvement, not only in their work product, but as an individual, to be a better person, to handle conflict better, to be a better communicator, to be a better friend, father, mother, sister, brother, where both of their worlds, their individual world is, you know, outside of the office, is strong and happy, which makes them a better employee, and then their work in the organization makes them happy, which sends them home as a better person. So for me, best people is all, at least in the book, is all around how do I perform well in an organization. So Jack, I'll turn it over to you now.
John, I absolutely agree with those two. I think they're absolutely critical, and I'm going to throw in two more that I believe are just as critical. And
I was
going
to say, you always have to one-up me, but now you're going to two-up me.
I'm going to two-up you, and if you keep going, I'll think of another one.
Yeah, by the time it's all over, he will 100.
I got my own ideas on this, but I'd like to know what you guys first.
Yeah, the two that I'm going to throw in there are responsibility and empathy. And what I mean by that is responsibility is that somebody takes a responsibility for the larger aims of the organization. It's not just, hey, it's my job, and I only do my job. So people take an ownership mentality, if you will, or responsibility, responsible for their results. And then, of course, empathy. And I thought of this when Marty was saying that there are essential tools that should be in every child's toolbox. I believe that you need to teach, I don't know if you need to teach it or you just need to bring it out, the natural empathy possibly that kids have. I'll leave it to the psychologist to comment on whether it's natural or a skill. I have my own ideas on that, of course, as John would say, but I do want to hear what you think on that.
Short answer is it's both. The truth is we know that there are things in the neural system that that facilitate one human being picking up the emotion of the other human being that they're with. And so we know that there's the biological substrate there, but we also know that that it's a skill that you can practice and get better at. There's an intellectual cognitive part of empathy that also is at play. So it's both. I'll also yield to Brian on this because he's probably got an even more science-based answer than I do.
Yeah, so I'll bring in somebody that I think all of us have conversed about over the years, Carl Rogers' work. And in psychology, he's considered one of the foremost experts on empathy. And one of the things that he found is that if people are in the presence of somebody who is being empathic, then they will naturally start to become more empathic. So it maps on really well to what Marty talked about, that most of us have this natural inclination to be empathic. In fact, a lot of the evolutionary psychologists have made a good case that if we weren't empathic, we wouldn't have survived as a species because we need to sort of band together in order to survive. We're not as big as elephants or as strong as gorillas. But that you also need to have some sort of model who doesn't even necessarily teach this to you, but is empathic to make it so that you are, if we go to the theme of this journey, to be excellent at empathy, you've got to be in the presence of someone who is showing you empathy. And one of the goals that I have for this journey into excellence is actually to promote a lot of this science of empathy, because I think, Jack, speaking a little bit to your responsibility and empathy, is I think that those things are linked, that the more empathic we are with other people, the more responsibility we sort of want to take for the mission, if the mission is a good mission for people, going back to that acronym that I use, H2O, if it's helpful to ourselves and others, then I do want to take more responsibility for that because I'm empathic toward the people that are working toward that mission. So, I think Marty nailed it, and I think Jack brought up two different kinds of experiences that I think are strongly linked. And I think thinking systemically back to the family, the education system, and the leadership management system, that we need to start developing people, and Rogers was writing and speaking about this 50, 60 years ago, that we need to, in our family systems, in our education systems, in our leadership management systems, we need to encourage people not to talk about empathy or study empathy, but to actually be empathic so that we can trigger some of these natural tendencies in other people.
Yeah, yeah, well, and that's that, Brian, that family role model is probably the most important.
Right.
Brian, I want to throw something at you regarding that. You know, people often ask, you often hear the question asked, if you go back, you know, to your younger days, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give yourself? Well, you know, what, all this kind of stuff. And I think it's a fascinating question, you know, or how would you live your life differently is another way it's asked. And I am a slow model. I tell people that all the time in the computer metaphor is that I come up with immediate answers and solutions, but then things just kind of rattle around and they're mull around and I re-challenge them, re-question them. And out of that, new things come up. Anyway, when I asked myself that question, the thing that really struck me is I don't think I would tell myself to live my life any differently. I've been very satisfied with the life I've lived. But the one thing that came up for me that I really thought about is that if I was to go back and instruct myself in what I would tell young people today, you know, who are all part of this discussion, even though they're not on the air with us right now, is if you're young or at any age in life, find yourself a mentor that's older than you for whatever station you are in life. And by mentor, I don't mean someone that tells you what to do or tells you what decisions to make in life. But a real mentor is something powerful. We may discuss that later. I have some thoughts about it. But I'm the host, not the panelist. So I throw that out to you. Because I really think, you know, I've been fortunate. My life was thrown adrift in my 20s as part of the Vietnam War. And my plans were totally uprooted and upset. And it led to a very fulfilling life that I would not have chosen for myself at the time, because it's left me in free in other ways. But anyway, I've been able to interact with young people most of my life, part of it being in graduate school, as a TA. I was displaced by a house fire in 2016 and lived 15 months in a hotel where all the young desk staff were 18 to 24-year-olds. And I would regularly engage them at the front desk to the chagrin of the manager who wanted them to work. And I'd always walk away and they'd say, "Oh, you really get us to think." And I've always found that if you show respect, you get respect across the age spectrum. Anyway, I think a mentor is that. That's what I would tell myself, is find yourself a mentor, a guide, much like the river raft guide in the back of the boat. He's been down the raft before. That's what I used to tell students in chemistry 1A classes. Is the only thing I know that you, well, aside from material, is one thing I know that you don't know right now is you can make it. I've been down this river before. I'm here to guide you through the rapids and things. So anyone want to say anything about that? Tell me.
Yeah, what I learned from Jack is as long as you're one chapter ahead of the class, everything's fine. You look like a genius. You don't have to be the fastest gazelle in the herd to survive. You just can't be the slowest.
Right. what I was going to bring up is that there are five potential barriers to goal achievement, one of which is lack of social support. And so one of the ways I think about having a mentor is that this is a person who understands your vision, mission, objectives, goals, and provides exactly the social support that you need at that time in your life to facilitate your achievements.
And I think that draws in the mentor idea with the empathy idea.
Right.
And I think that the most empathic mentors are best for people for a variety of reasons, and maybe we can keep swimming around the empathy waters.
Maybe you can't be a mentor, series. Brian. Maybe you can't be a mentor if you don't have empathy for the one you're mentoring.
Well, I don't think you can be an excellent mentor if we're going to use the the title of the series, right? So I think excellent mentors, just like what Marty talked about, I think a lot of mentors who sort of aspire to be mentors, they think, well, what I'll do is I'll give advice, and like you said that you don't do, Vernon, is I'll tell people what to do. I'm older. I know better. What we're finding is that those are the exact kinds of mentors that disturb growth in individuals. The sort of mentors that produce growth in individuals are the sort of mentors that Marty, I think, was alluding to, and these are mentors that are not there to give you advice, not there to say, I'm older so I know the water, but they're what I think it's a Stanford psychiatrist, I think he's a professor emeritus now, really well regarded in our field, Irvin Yalom. He calls these Marty, I'm forgetting the name. Do you remember what Irvin Yalom says that he wants to be a I'm forgetting. So basically he wants to walk with the person, not walk in front of the person.
Yep.
And I think what that gets to is that the mentors there, they understand the goals, the objectives, the activities that people want to engage in. And they are walking the path with that person, not a few steps ahead saying, hey, I know where you're supposed to go. And it gets to it.
And I'd like to throw in there, I think there's a couple of risks that you can run into with mentorship. Is number one, if you do walk ahead of somebody, you're going to tell them what to do and they're not going to learn for themselves. So I'm a strong believer in asking the right questions to get people to arrive at the conclusions that are going to be best for them, because that's where they're going to take ownership. And the second point I wanted to make is back to your point, Vern, about a mentor should have empathy, but you also can't take it so far that you don't have enough detachment from the situation to be able to use your judgment, possibly where your mentee may be so wrapped up in the emotional aspect of it that they can't see the big picture.
Well, I think that is empathy. When you really realize that I was in a men's group many years ago, and we had a young guy that was claimed to be a recovering alcoholic and stuff. And we'd be in our meetings, and he'd go on. He starts saying when he realized his life wasn't working and the laundry'd pile up and this and that and whatever wouldn't get done. I looked at him one day and I says, you know, here's what you need to do. Here's my suggestion. You don't need to do anything. Is when you see the laundry piling up, do it. When you see the dishes piling up, do it. When you see the houses getting dirty, clean it up. Mm-hmm. And then come back and tell me how your life is working or not. And because somehow, rather than using things as an indication that they weren't working, rather than handling them, it seemed to me as he just got in there and started doing them, he could discover something else. And that's what I mean by empathy, and I hear that in your voice too, is that a good mentor isn't going to suck you in and tell someone something's all fine and cherries and roses when it's not,
right,
or that they're doing the right thing when they're not. It's like a good sensei if you're in the martial arts. He'll probably slip in a punch or two and let you know what happens when you're not on guard. My thoughts.
I want to jump in and tell you the term. I just remembered the term from Irvin Yalom. He calls it being a fellow traveler.
Okay.
As a mentor. Yeah, walking the path with people rather than trying to tell people which path to go down.
Yeah, and there's too little of the fellow traveler aspect in the world as I see it. And I can only tell you the way I see it. That's my worry. Everyone's trying to tell everyone how it should be done, and I'm not well read in Wittgenstein, but I like his comment where he says my propositions are elucidatory, and that's the way I
did. You say elucidatory or hallucinatory?
Elucidatory.
Those are serious questions, aren't they, Zach?
No, that's a serious question. Which one did you say?
Well, no, hallucinatory, but hallucinatory can provide some input too. As many people that have engaged in ayahuasca and the psilocybin gods and mescalito would tell you as well.
Yeah. And by the way, just drawing on an academic discipline, which I don't really talk about much. I actually have a master's in Soviet studies. The term fellow traveler carries a totally different connotation in the field of international politics.
Could you carry that a little farther? Because I think that's wonderful. Because I think we do this series.
A fellow
I think we
traveler
should talk about language a lot.
A fellow traveler is what the Soviets used to call the people in the capitalist countries, people who were working secretly on their behalf.
Interesting.
Without getting into current politics, I could probably give you an example, but I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and I think that also weaves into the topic of empathy, because part of empathy is understanding what different words mean to different people. So I think that's a great lesson on the importance of kind of checking in and saying, does this phrase mean the same thing to you as it does to me?
Yeah, exactly. To call somebody a fellow traveler, especially in the 50s and 60s, was considered a huge insult.
I don't have it in front of me. I'll pull it up for the next one. But that reminds me of an old attorney joke to that extent, where a woman goes in and a man goes in and says, man, woman, doesn't matter, says, I want a divorce. He says, well, does he beat you? Well, he gets up before me every day and goes down this litany, you know. Do you have a grudge? Oh, no, we don't have a grudge, but we have a carport. It goes all the way down. It ends up the attorney says, if he doesn't beat
nice.
You don't have a grudge, et cetera. He says, why do you want a divorce? And she says, because we can't seem to communicate.
Cute. Perfect. I love it. Cute.
In the remaining, we're getting actually, believe it or not, we're down to about 12 minutes of this show, and you guys are busy gentlemen. So as we go in the last 12 minutes, let's talk a little bit about how we want to structure the show in the future for the listeners to know. One of the things I was thinking could be very good is to take each one of you in your turn and pick a topic that you want to present to the show that you'll kind of open up with for the first 10, 15 minutes, which we will then kick around. That's one thought. Anyone else have any thoughts? Silence.
Well, I'll say that I'm hoping that okay, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying this is like a class. You ask a question, no one can answer.
No. One of the things that I'm hoping we can do, because one of my visions for this podcast, like I said earlier, is to open people up to what I feel like I've been so privileged to have access to, and that is conversations like this with John and Jack and Marty and some other people that we might be bringing to the podcast. I would love for certain portions of the podcast to maybe be set aside where we could talk about different kinds of specific activities that listeners could engage in if they wanted to pursue excellence in the ways that we think about it. So, for example, the kind of exercise that John was speaking about that the woman got so impacted by, maybe we could give to our listeners some of these ideas so that they can actually work on their own journey into excellence as they continue to listen to us.
Okay, do you want to prepare that part for the next show, Brian?
I'd be happy to do that if that's what everyone's okay with.
That sounds great to me.
Vernon, one of the things all four of us have in common is we really focus on actionable things.
Yep.
So if you look at the careers of each of us, a uniting theme is we try to provide people with very specific ways of thinking, tools, and so on that they can use to benefit themselves, their organizations, their families right now. And so I think what Brian is getting at is we want to make sure that these podcasts reflect that lifelong commitment that each of the four of us in different ways has demonstrated and make sure that people walk away with things they can use, specific, straightforward things that have a track record of being beneficial.
Perfect. Perfect. Are you going to start putting together some of those tools for the next show, Brian?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, and I would, if the other members of the panel are happy to do that as well, I think that would be great if we could share with each other and with our audience some of the most impactful activities that we share with our clients and with each other.
Because I think that's excellent, Martin. You know, that old saying is really true. There's a point where the rubber meets the road, and if you can't put things into action, it's kind of all words.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You know, there's an old saying, action talks, bullshit walks.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bullshit walking around the planet today. And I agree. That's one of the things I'm excited about, is this show to provide a platform, foundation, whatever you want to call it, for our listening audience to go take what they hear on this show and go out into life. And I think we've given them kind of a flavor of the panel so far today. I'm excited about that. We've discussed a lot of ideas. And as we're coming to the end of the show, I think it's important, because you brought this up earlier, Marty, you know, what do we intend to accomplish? And as you just said, we want to leave the audience with things they can do, whether it be write down, you know, what's most important to you? What's the focus? What are your goals in life? It's never too late to start.
No. Yep. Oh, by the way, Vern, I've spent about 2.5 decades of my life working as an adult with Scouts. And so I have alternative ways of saying the thing that you pointed out, one of which is when all is said and done, a lot more is said than done. And I think that may be a more PG version of exactly what you were talking about.
I think that's great that you bring that up, because many years ago, and I've shared this with Brian along the way, someone said something that has fascinated me since I heard it in the 80s, and that was a simple phrase called mastery of the body of knowledge. And I think it's an enticing, exotic way of saying is, how many different ways can you express the same or similar idea and recognize them as being pretty much the same? And your example of Boy Scouts is exactly the same in analogous to action talks, bullshit walks. And therein, I think a lot of clarity resides. When are we talking about the same thing? When are we not? You know, and anyway, I don't want to go off on a tangent on that.
I have just a quick question. And I love the idea of preparing suggestions and actionable items for listeners to take. Will there be a mechanism for us to get feedback or comments or questions from listeners that we can then answer in our – and I don't mean live on air, but I mean between episodes possibly.
Yeah, here's how I envision this evolving, okay, just some thoughts. Yeah, I've been doing this. Like I say, I scheduled this originally as a private show, so it's not out there. This particular account I have can host up to 50 callers at a time, and I have done live shows and people can call in. When this is done, you know, I will I'll probably add some lead-in music and end out music. I haven't decided which, and I'll put it out for all of you to listen to, and I will post it, and I invite all of you to post it on your websites, your blogs, and whatever, to make people aware that we're out here. And as we do that and expand, I would also allow, you know, request that people send us either through email or whatever questions they might have. And I'd actually like to eventually open the show up to a listener base that we build in time, that people can listen live in real time, and as something strikes them, call in and we can take calls. That's all an evolving vision on my behalf, but it's your show. It's really your
show.
Sounds great. Something I'm creating the way I see that is I've bantered back and forth with Brian. He beats me up all the time on Facebook. He's cruel. he talks about empathy, but he is brutal to the end.
he has empathized you within an inch of your life, hasn't he?
he's empathyless. And anyway, that's how this actually started, because I did Block Talk Radio, internet radio, for 3-4 years till my wife broke her hip, and then subsequently I was displaced by a fire. She wound up passing away, so I haven't done as much internet radio in a long time. And I thought, what an excellent opportunity! So I just kind of threw it out to Brian, says, "You need to get on. You know, we've we've chatted back and forth on Facebook. So I'd never really heard his voice until up till recently. And so I intrigued him enough that here we are off on a flagship journey together, and I'm excited about it. So it really is your show. As far as I'm concerned, I'm a partner in its creation, and will bring whatever I can to it in terms of, you know, hosting experience, and or I will throw in thoughts that I've had, as I have done today. But it is your show. It really is a show of professionals that we're putting together in the form of podcasts, and ultimately I'd love to see it go live, that we're working on. So the sky's the limit. It's one of the beautiful things about the technology, and what I used to say when I used to host with the trolls, is what a waste of the technology to try and troll stuff and be shocking. When we've got the possibility in this day and age, we don't have a radio studio, but we can reach the world. These things I will put them on my Blog Talk Radio account, and people start to listen and sign up and subscribe. So the answer to the question, that was a long answer to a short question, is there any way we can get questions from people in the future? Oh, I'm counting on it, hoping for it, and looking forward to it, and that's part of the show expansion. This is day one.
And I'll jump in real quick, Vernon, and say that one of the reasons I brought these panelists to you is because you talk about opening up to the world. And I think that these people are some people that if we get more and more of their ideas out into the world, I think the world improves. So that's really part of my vision, is getting more and more people listening to the Jacks and Johns and Martys of the world and thinking about implementing some of their ideas in their families and their education systems and in their leadership management systems. So I love it.
Well, I'm going to give you all – by the way, the third beauty about this is that I set up the show for 2 hours so that if we go over time, it doesn't matter. It would only affect people that were listening online. They'd be cut off at the end of the show. But in closing, I'd like each one of you to kind of summarize, give a little comment, how you felt about the show today. Did you enjoy it? And I'd like to thank you all for being here. Give kind of a closing comment. And we'll wrap it up together. Martin, you go first.
Good. So what I was actually thinking was, I cannot wait to engage in a conversation with the four of you, because there is so much. I've been familiar with Brian's work very intimately, and John's work. I've read a couple of his books. And Jack is, I read stuff online of Jack's, and so I'm yearning for us to have the natural combustion of this process, and I can't wait to be a listener as much as I want to be a participant in this process.
Well, you'll be able to do that after the show is over. It'll be posted, and you can go back and listen to it and take notes. John, any comments? John, are you awake? Did we lose John?
Hello, John.
Got me now?
Yeah, I got you now.
Okay,
I hit
the mute on my microphone by mistake. One thing I want to let you know real quick, Vernon, I will not be here every single time, as with my wife's health, I'm taking care of her a lot, so from time to time I might be too busy or traveling. But when I am here, I love the conversation we had today, some real neat ideas playing off each other. But, Marty, I want to underscore what you said, is I want to make sure that when someone listens to this, it's more than just an intellectual exercise, that they walk away with cool new ideas, but especially things they can go out and apply in their lives, that we can give them workshops or tools or ideas, post things on our websites or whatever where they can go download it to take the ideas that we're using and turn them into positive action in their lives. That's my major comment.
Jack?
Well, I really can't say any better what Marty and John just said. I do just want to note that the name of this is A Journey into Excellence, and I see this as all five of us, John, are embarking on a journey into excellence together. And I couldn't think of better fellow travelers to enjoy it with. Oh.
That was very good. Brian.
Yeah, be careful with that. You should be careful with that term. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, Brian, we opened up with you as the first commentator. Take us on home.
Okay, yeah. So just going to kind of echo what was just said. One of the reasons why I'm so excited about this podcast series is because I think we're bringing some of the best minds, at least from my perspective, in the world to help people to get where they want to go in life, have the kind of lives that they want, at the end of life, look back with integrity rather than despair, which is what I think it's all about. And I'm just really thrilled to be able to have these kinds of minds coming together on a regular basis and talking about things that matter to us and also allowing people in on that discussion, because like I said at the beginning of this, this has been multiple decades that's been really helpful to myself. And getting back to the acronym that I like to use all the time, H2O, helpful to ourselves and others, I'm really excited to take what's been really helpful to ourselves and offer it to as many others who are interested. So I really think that this is the beginning of something big, even if it's just for us. I think it's big. I would sit around and talk with you guys for hours, regardless of whether or not it's a show. But I hope we can also make it life-changing and perhaps even world-changing for other people. So really grateful for all your time. I know it's super valuable, and I appreciate every one of you.
Yeah, I want to say to you all, thank you very much for being part of the show. Thanks for allowing me to host it. Thanks for allowing me to be introduced to you all. Like I say, it's a real pleasure for me to be your host. I look forward to this. I think it's an excellent use of a technology that's evolved over the world, a technology that is frequently used for fairly nefarious things that can be really used to make a difference on the planet. And I look forward to the journey as we go on together. And unless anyone else has anything to say, I'll sign out. My name is Vernon Bohr. You've been listening to A Journey into Excellence with Jack Malcolm, Brian P. Higley, John Spence, and Jack Malcolm. And we will catch you in 1 month.